Thanks so much, John and Jeff. We've just concluded what let's call the presentation version of the briefing, and let's go on to what we might call the conversation stage. And so what I want to do is just ask a series of questions of one of the other panelists, and of course just interested in your response, and I'll give the other one a chance to briefly respond if necessary.
Could I just respond on the transparency board?
Okay, very quickly.
So I think if the question is we're worried about individual tort victims being taken advantage of by a funder, and states have worried about that, I think there some form of transparency makes sense. Like the most important thing there would be to have, you know, the transparency in terms of what the terms are, what you're getting into, and competition, so they're not being overcharged. But really it's transparency so that the lawyer representing those clients understands and protects them from being taken advantage of. I don't really see why the defendant in that suit would be the one best positioned to look out for an individual personal injury victim. Again, it's a completely different industry from what we'd be talking about. So if there were some sort of proposal for individuals who are personal injury victims, we're going to find a way to protect them. I just want to make sure that that's not going to catch up when a sophisticated general counsel of a company is negotiating with a finance provider, that that's somehow going to be subject to some sort of disclosure to the other side in litigation. Because if a general counsel went down the hall to the CFO and said, how should we finance this case? That's protected. It's work product, their strategy. If they bring in a litigation funder and their outside counsel in that conversation, that should similarly be protected. And there's no reason government would intervene to protect a sophisticated general counsel of a company. But for individuals that are tort victims, I can understand why you might say they have to make sure that the lawyer knows what they're getting themselves into. And I know there is variation. This isn't our field, but having looked at it as a scholar, there are some providers who do that, who won't do a deal with an individual unless their lawyer knows, and there are others who seem like they go around the backs of the lawyer, and I can see that would be an issue.
And there are lawyers who do the same thing, who will advise their clients basically don't do a violation,
right,
unless we see it and we get a chance to
advise
on it.
Right. Is the red light on, or is the red light supposed to be off?
Can't tell.
You were loud.
So I think you can hear us in the back either way, right?
So. Okay. Yeah.
All right. So I had asked that we have a little conference call, and I'd asked John and Jeff this earlier, and it may be of some interest to those of you in the audience. You know, they define on the internet, you know, you read third-party litigation finances, a situation where just some third party funds the litigation, but it doesn't really say the different methods that are used to do that. So I asked John, is it ever structured as a loan? And if it's a loan, is it a loan to the client or a loan to the law firm? I think you've answered that. It can be either now. So it can be structured as a loan or some kind of equity participation. The funder takes, some share of the contingency fee above some amount, or so there are all sorts of different ways that these things can be financed, and I'm very curious about how the different methods of finance are used in different circumstances depending on the potential maligned incentives of the attorney and or client. So if it's structured as a debt claim, that is, I'll give you a certain amount of money, let's say $500,000, if you prevail, you pay me $1 million. So that's just a fixed amount. Now, at some point, it may be in the attorney's interest to kind of roll the dice, right? Because if failure looms, why not take a chance, right? So that kind of arrangement might tend to increase the riskiness of the underlying litigation activity. On the other hand, if the funder is taking a share of any award, then the problem there is it might dilute the incentives of the attorney to really fully engage in the litigation. So that's a question I have for you, but let me cap that one by asking a very simple question. If there is this certification function, suppose there's, let's say, a law firm that has a good case, a client with a good case, they don't know if it's a good case. It's uncertain. Is this a good case or isn't this a good case? They could fund it if they wanted, you know, take it in a contingency basis, or maybe the client has the money. But why not go to a Burford and ask for, you know, a bid, how much would you fund for this? And then if Burford says, yeah, we'll give you $2 million for that, all right? And then say, okay, bye-bye. We've got the certification, we've got the information,
yep.
And now, so how do you stop that?
So you, to some extent you don't, right? You know, we're repeat players with good relationships with law firms and companies. We have probably our biggest competition is the company deciding to self-fund, they decide the capital is too expensive. So there are times people come to us and say, would you fund this? And we tell them we would, and we come up with terms, and they say, well, it's very interesting, we think about it, but I think we're gonna fund it ourselves. Law firms as well, and we're okay with that. I think about an Am Law 100 firm or a partner, you know, saw an email coming around saying, we've got a good corporate client that has a piece of litigation they want to do on a contingency. Can we recommend a contingency lawyer? And the partner's like, well, what do you mean? We could do it and partner with Burford. So he called me, I talked to him about it, he went off and pitched to the client, and the client was so impressed that he was thinking about the client's bottom line, he decided to retain him, but decided for now, you know, I'll pay you hourly. So we're okay with that, and that happens, and particularly happens on defense side. I look at a lot of defense side deals where there's a litigation that's gonna interfere with a merger or a private equity deal, and they're looking for us to take the risk, and we'll look at it and come up with a price for the risk, and as long as they know we can take the risk, they're willing to go forward with the merger and take the defense side risk. Sometimes they'll take the money and sometimes they won't. Your earlier, reminder.
Method of financing tips the incentives of the attorney.
So it's important to keep in mind that the interests of client and lawyer, when there's no third party funder involved, may not be aligned. If you're billing by the hour, the lawyer's incentive is to bill more hours, not to get the most efficient result. But they do have professional obligations. And if they're billing a contingency, every hour they put into the matter is their own cost, whereas they only get a third of the recovery. So to some extent, having a third-party funder involved, where there's some risk being taken by the lawyer, but the lawyer's getting some discounted fee available, and the client's putting in some money, but not as much, actually helps align interests more than I think without it. And frankly, we purposely would structure deals knowing that, you know, you don't want to create misincentives. You don't want to say, we're going to take a multiple that's going to be so high that you're not going to be able to sell. And we, you know, and it really depends on the client. You know, the general counsel of a company comes and says, we think we've got a $5 billion claim here. We don't want to give you a third. We'd much rather give you investment back plus 2x plus a small percentage. And then somebody else comes along and says, we just want to share. We don't know where this is going to go. And we can structure it however works best for the law firm and the client.
All right, Jeff, do you have any response to that?
Yeah, I think I'll just say, and John may actually be able to speak this a little bit more, I think the one thing to think about, I mean, there are multiple ways to structure these things, and then there is also in the background ethical rules that do place some limits, guidelines, whatever, on how you can do that. So, for example, there's a rule that bars the splitting of an attorney's fee with another, with a non-lawyer. That implicates potentially, at least in some states where it's applicable, how you can structure the agreement, who, you know, where the money has to be sourced from. It is fine to source the money from, ethically it's fine to source the money from the client's recovery if the client, of course, agrees to that. There's also an issue of control, so the lawyer has to always maintain independent judgment, and that's the lawyer's responsibility. There have been cases where the courts have looked at a fee arrangement, a third-party litigation funding arrangement, and determined that it was so coercive that it was not possible realistically for the litigant to maintain control of its situation. So there are ethical sort of principles that I think kind of constrain, and the best practices in the industry, you know, acknowledge that control is not supposed, you can't sort of, as a funder, exert as a condition of agreement that you will control litigation. Like, control has to remain vested in the lawyer and the client, especially when it comes to matters at critical junctures in the litigation, like settlement or resolution. So those place some constraints, I think, on, because you can't do it explicitly. You can't do it implicitly either, right? Like, you can't have such coercive terms that the practical effect of it is that the lawyer has kind of surrendered independent professional judgment where the client has surrendered control over the case to the funder. So there will, in cases where these disputes happen, there may be disputes over whether, you know, the conditions were so onerous that it effectively transferred control to the funder. And so that's something that a funder, I think, would have to keep in mind in figuring out and negotiating terms with a potential client. And of course, it would depend on the nature of the client as well. Probably less likely to be an issue with a sophisticated client like a business than it would be in a case involving a consumer or an individual of that nature.
Let me just peel the onion just a little on that, so that kind of situation that came to my mind is, so suppose the funder provides a fixed level of funding, and then the law firm bills the client hourly. The funder might retain the right to at least see the bills, I would think, and possibly even question whether the billing is proper or not. And my concern might be that could be used as a lever to exert control over the substance of the litigation. So that's one possible example. But
I mean, my feeling is that's actually a wonderful tool for a client. I mean, partly it was decades ago, the move toward having sophisticated in-house lawyers was a move toward being able to control outside legal spend, right? And that's something that companies went through. It used to just be you'd have your outside lawyer, you'd hire, you know, ask the lawyer. They didn't have a general counsel who was at the Capitol or someone coming from being a scouting partner, and they've changed that. And I think to the extent for smaller companies in particular, but even for bigger companies that have very sophisticated in-house litigation staff, nonetheless, having a funder working as their partner who's looking at the budget, and frankly, having the law firm, having somebody that is thinking it through in that way too, because particularly if the law firm's going to take some risk and they're not billing hundreds and dollars, they're billing at a discount, they want to know at the beginning, they want to budget it out and see that it's going to be a good economic proposition for the law firm too. So I have found client and lawyer alike are very happy for that involvement. Not control, but happy for like having another set of eyes that you don't charge by the hour for that time too.
No, I can see it. I can certainly see that. It's just a question of, you know, whether it could be used as a lever.
And maybe I should say, for both of the concerns, like, there can be the unethical lawyer who is taking advantage of the client. There can be the unethical hourly fee lawyer who's overbilling the client. Yeah, that happens. I don't think the introduction of litigation finance aggravates. To some extent, I think it ameliorates the problem because there's a third set of eyes. Like, the hardest thing is when it's just the lawyer and the client, you have the risk that, particularly in a small individual case, even though we don't do that, that an unethical contingent fee attorney can be pushing the client to do something that he should not, right? That he can be pushing for settlement when he should be going to trial and he's too lazy to, or he, you know, or because he wants to, you know, cut a deal with somebody that he has a good relationship with in another case, or he can be pushing go to trial when it clearly is a case that should settle and he's trying to make a name for it or recoup his losses, whatever it is, he's trying to, you know, and it's not in the client's interest. Having a third party present who's sophisticated to, you know, looking over the shoulder of both sides is not a bad thing. And if there's worries about an unethical funder, and I understand in the personal injury space you worry about that, well, having a lawyer present to mediate that relationship is very important.
Yeah, I think it really just depends on the facts of the case. Because you're right, you can have bad lawyers and you can have bad funders. In one case, you may have one, in another case, you may have the other. And a lot of the cases, I mean, to your point about how this is maybe more of a personal injury issue than a business-to-business issue, I think most of the decisions that we have that involve disputes like this, you know, does the funder have too much control, have been suits involving individual plaintiffs or class plaintiffs, which raises a whole other category of concerns because there, ethically at least, because there, the lawyer's responsibility and the named plaintiff's responsibility is not merely to the named plaintiff, but also the absent class member. So you have sort of another weight on the ethical scale that figures into, does the funder have too much control here? Especially because, again, as we mentioned earlier, you've got to pay the funder from something. You can't split it from the legal fees, and you've got to take it out of the recovery. That takes on a different dimension ethically when the recovery would belong to the class, because the class isn't there at the time of the funding agreement to say yes or no, we approve or disapprove of this arrangement. So that's sort of the area where I think it's more likely to generate those kinds of disputes.
I'm not aware of cases without court approval where somebody is financing a class action and getting paid out of anything other than what would be the lawyer's portion.
Yeah, there was a Northern District of California case, Gubarabe, and I don't remember exactly what the arrangement was there. I thought it was going to be sourced at least in part, like for both, like part of the lawyer's fee and then part of the recovery as well. But I just
I think you have to have court approval, because as you say, I don't think the named plaintiff could even, the named plaintiff can't even bind the class for contingency, right? The
right.
Court has to approve. So I'm thinking the named plaintiff can't contract with a funder and say, I'll give you a share of your
And this is one of the, I mean, some of the reforms or proposed reforms in this area have focused on class actions, I think, for that reason, because it's just a much more thorny set of interests that are implicated. But bottom line is, it'll just depend on the situation. I think it's relatively unlikely that you're going to have this kind of control dispute in a business-to-business situation, at least, or at least it's more likely to happen in a situation where you've got individual plaintiffs who may not really know when they're signing up for litigation.
All right, well, so before we go further, I do want to let the audience know that we'll reserve time for you to ask questions, maybe 10 minutes at the end. As we're just going along here for the next 10 minutes or so, just if you think you have a question for the last 10 minutes, just raise your hand. If I don't see any hands, then we'll just keep going, all right? Okay, so here's a question I have. I dug it out of my imagination. Maybe I'm just full of beans here. As to the long-run incentives of litigation funders regarding kind of litigation strategy. So we might think of, say, an insurance company. What would be their long-run litigation strategy? They have cases strung out in front of them. How do they want to proceed? You know, so what's their strategy? What are they after? One strategy is they want to win all their cases, right? They want a legal rule that's tipped in favor of insurance companies. Well, that's not going to work. But as a backup to that, what they might want is to develop legal rules that are clear, right? So they can calculate their risk and, you know, have their actuaries tell them how much to charge for their policies, and as little of whatever they have to pay out goes to pay attorneys as possible. So they want clear legal rules. So in that kind of long-run litigation strategy sense, is it the case that that litigation funders, third-party litigation funders, have good strategy? I mean, the superficial response is no, they want unclear law, right? Now, I'm going to let Jeff answer that first, and I'm sure John is going to want to rebut.
Yeah, so let me answer a slightly different question than the one you're asking, which is it a good thing that we expand litigation through third-party litigation funding so that we can create clearer precedents and answer important issues that remain unanswered, which could then perhaps guide future third-party litigation funding investments or future actions by the client or what have you? I think the answer to that is it depends. It really depends on whether you think that the filter, the bar, to bringing these suits that aren't coming because they aren't funded is a rational filter in terms of keeping frivolous lawsuits out of the litigation system, or whether it's totally irrational and it's barring totally just suits and there's no reason why the suit doesn't have enough money before is unrelated to the merits of the suit. And I think, again, in my context, consumer litigation, mass torts litigation, I think the filter is working. I don't think that cases that have merit are generally not being brought forward. I think because of the way contingency fees work, if there's, for example, a product defect allegation out there, there's plenty of qualified lawyers who are going to investigate that, identify it, find clients, bring those cases. The only thing that litigation funding is really going to do in that context is expand further already very large portfolios. And there's already, in the mass tort context, no incentive at all to do quality control as a plaintiff's lawyer, as long as you believe in the overall theory that there's something wrong with the product, right? Because the more cases you have, the more influence you wield. And if you have multi-district litigation where there's thousands of cases pending, if you come in with a huge chunk of cases, you can compete for important positions on like liaison committees and stuff like that, and wield a tremendous amount of influence over the path of the litigation. So in that situation, I think there's not really a role for third-party litigation funding to sort of answer legal questions that aren't being answered, but it might be totally different in a context where the reason things aren't being brought is because of the type of suit you were talking about earlier, where you've got to pay somebody on an hourly basis, and the payday that's going to come is years down the road. there, the market filter that is currently in place may not be filtering cases out based on their merits. They may be filtering them out for other reasons.
And I'd say when it comes to like test cases in law, so it's an interesting hypothetical question, but I don't think that litigation finance really has any relevance to it. It's a practical matter because as a litigation finance provider, the last thing I want to do is fund a test case. Right? What I love is, you know, cases always end up more interesting than you like them to be, but I love just the boring commercial dispute where it's settled law, you hear what the facts are, you know the person should win, and the thing that's holding back is the parties, right? It's the person that doesn't. It's just a method of corporate finance. The party wants finance as opposed to the parties trying to test some legal theory. And there's two reasons why that's true. One, because test cases often lose. So, you know, it may be that it's appropriate for an interest group that raises money as a 501c3 to take a test case in order to establish some principle. That's not what a for-profit corporation wants to do. You want to make money off your suits. You only want to take cases that are likely to win. If they're likely to lose because they're weak and meritless, then they should lose. Or if they're likely to lose, even though, like, in a better world, the suit would win, but that's not the world we're living in. The litigation finance provider views both of those the same way. It's not likely to make money, and we're not going to invest it. We're not like, yes, you're doing well while doing good because you're taking meritorious claims by companies that need the finance for something else. Right? They'd rather spend their money keeping their employees doing their thing rather than on litigation, and you're getting them to recover. That's positive for the world, but we're not changing the law. And the other reason, well, why wouldn't you change the law if there were a particular area of antitrust in your area? You know, would you want to take a test case because you've changed the law and you fund more cases? But the way litigation finance works is you have a diverse portfolio of cases across subject matter. What drives the cases you take is what the clients want, right? A corporation could have a contract dispute, an antitrust dispute, all sorts of things. We'll take whatever it is as long as it has merit. We're not focused on a particular area of law where we want to change the law. If anything, it would actually be a reason not to invest in a case if you have too much concentration in that area, because then you might lose too much money if a whole bunch of correlated cases could lose.
If you're interested in asking a question, let me see the hand. Okay. So I'm wondering what the frontiers are in this industry. We tend to think of third-party litigation finance as being on the plaintiff's side. And I'm wondering if there are circumstances in which it's on the defense side or might in the future be on the defense side. Let me just take a quick example. So this is lore that, you know, every econ finance professor might teach to his undergraduates. So in 1980, there was the MGM Grand Hotel fire, right? The event on which the movie Towering Inferno was based. Okay, and I think what happened there was MGM had policy, I'm making the numbers up, let's say they had policy limits of $180 million. And after the dust settled and the smoke cleared, MGM Grand estimated that the total payout would be $200 million. That is, they'd have to pay out an extra $20 million in excess of their policy limit with the insurer. But what happened there was the insurer wrote backdated policy to cover the full liability. And, you know, I asked the students, why is this? Well, they want to establish a good reputation. My response to that, of course, is the guy who says, well, I lose 20 cents on every shirt. Well, how do you make money? Well, I make it up in volume, right? So how are you ever going to make money if you're an insurance company that way? I think, to make a long story short, the answer is that if MGM Grand was to oversee the attorneys who were litigating these liability claims in excess of the policy limits, I mean, MGM Grand doesn't know how to do that, right? They're going to get eaten alive. The insurance company knows how to do that. So the story would be the insurance company wrote a backdated policy to cover that what would be an extra $20 million if MGM litigated it. They charged MGM $15 million, and ultimately, because of their expertise, it came in at $10 million. So gains from trade, right?
I think that's a great thing. That is something we look at all the time. I mean, the idea is, historically, the reason that insurers haven't done it is they like to insure risks where you're taking a large pool of similarly situated people and you're doing actuarial analysis You know, what's the likelihood you're going to be picked out? Litigation is the opposite of that. You're taking something based on its unique circumstances and evaluating the risk. So it's a little bit like selling fire insurance as you're walking down the street and someone's house is on fire. And you say, do you think it's going to be confined to the kitchen or is it going to make it upstairs to the bedroom? I'll sell you insurance now. Who insures the burning building? That's what litigation finance. But it is a different risk. The risk of whether an insurance litigating event will happen versus how much it will cost once you're litigated, and it could work in mass tort. I think it's securities is a place that could be really helpful because often, historically, plaintiff's attorneys would look at a securities case, they know what insurance limits are, they know the incentive of the corporate officers in the company are, if it can be settled within insurance limits, we want to do it. And the insurer thinks if we refuse to agree to a settlement within limits, we could be exposed to a bad faith refusal to settle claim. So the fact that there are insurance limits there actually give the plaintiff's attorneys a target of where to settle, and you could blow that away by banding together and saying, guess what? We're providing insurance above those limits. Let's fight it out. You know, you're not gonna have the insurer caving in limits. So I think there are uses, and in fact, the first article I wrote in the area was about defense side transfers. We do it, that is the place to your question where people call us the most and then choose not to buy it.
No, okay.
Because the problem is with affirmative litigation, once they have the prospect of it and they're like, oh, we don't have to spend the money now, it's very appealing. With defensive, it's like, will that bad thing come to pass or can we keep that risk? Maybe we'll just keep the risk rather than paying you the premium. The time that it works is when the risk is interfering with a deal. Like if there's a merger, and the defendant says, oh, I'm okay with this risk. But the buyer of the company is like, I'm buying you because you're making widgets. I'm not buying you because I think your lawsuit's going to cost $50 million instead of $200 million. And then someone else will take it.
Yeah. I don't have a ton to add to that. I'll just say, at least so far in my experience, third-party litigation buying on the defense side is not a bad thing. I understand that there may be some of that out there, especially when it comes to cases where the defendant has a counterclaim that you can sort of fund the same way that you would fund a plaintiff's affirmative claim in the first instance. But we've not really encountered that so far in my practice, so I can't really say that much about it.
Okay. There's a question right here in the front row.
Yeah, actually a question for Jeff and a question for John, and I'll be brief. You mentioned, John, some deals not going through because of onerous conditions. And I'm curious about those because at some level this sounds like any small law firm that gets a plaintiff who is going to be big cost litigation of some sort can go to the local bank and get a liquidity loan. And the bank's just like, it's financial terms, you know. But they're not getting it. The bank is generally not going to become sort of a partner in the litigation. So I'm wondering what sort of onerous terms have you seen that wouldn't be in an ordinary bank loan situation? And John, for you real quick, this is financing, and I start thinking about financial products that spin off the basic model. Mm-hmm. And of course, we all know the big mortgage-backed securities
right.
thing. Is that what we're looking at on the frontier? Is mortgage-backed litigation investment products, which will, like the mortgage-backed securities, potentially be a huge updraft pull on the amount of litigation, because it's the more litigation we can start packaging into, you know, litigation financing-backed securities, the better because of the transaction fees. So sorry to conflate those two, but thought I'd get it out.
Sure, and thanks for the question. The one example that comes to mind is a recent case from the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, Federal Court, where, and to your question, I'm not sure where all these loans originate. I don't know why, for example, in some cases, as seems to have been the case here, the client, the plaintiff, gets the funding as opposed to the firm. Why this particular plaintiff couldn't find a contingency lawyer to take his case, but apparently that was the case. He got in advance through a series of four loans on his potential recovery in a case where he was suing the manufacturer of a gas can because vapor escaping the can exploded and injured him. And the terms of those agreements were 5% per month, which worked out to nearly 80% per year, so that the amount due on a $5,000 loan after 40 months was over $34,000. And so that was a case where the Sixth Circuit said, this is so onerous, it basically violates both state usury laws and state laws against getting a stake in somebody else's litigation, which are called champered rules that some states have. The court held that that was not an enforceable agreement, basically like, you know, a payday loan type thing, yeah, in essence, under state law. So that's one example. I mean, just in terms of the actual numbers, you know, 80% per year interest rate is what some of these loans have carried in terms of the terms. But again, we don't really know because there aren't a huge number of examples out here because these terms do not usually come to the surface.
And they weren't onerous in the sense of being interfering in the professional and independence of the litigating attorney.
There were additional terms.
Where they started to kind of get into the practice of law.
So in this particular case, not every sort of action taken by the funder was detailed, but the terms of the agreement included a limitation on the plaintiff's right to change attorneys without the funder's consent. Otherwise, the loan would become immediately due. The funder also had the right to review case files and any record relating to the plaintiff's case, including all the plaintiff's medical records. So it's a pretty deep level of involvement in some of these cases. Whether that amounts to control, merely having access to, you know, medical records or the records in the case, it is a public docket, so I'm not sure that that's like a huge amount of control. But where you do say you can't change lawyers, you know, if you do something that we don't agree with, you're going to have to pay the loan back whether you win the case or not. I mean, that does, as the court held, effectively give control to the funder in a very real way over the course of the litigation.
Okay, thank you.
So the big contrast I draw with mortgage-backed securities is the problem with mortgage-backed securities was excessive leverage, right? That people were borrowing more, driving up home prices, these were being packaged, and what was being sold to everyone is, because this is a diversified pool, what are the chances that all these people are going to all default? Historically, default rates were low. Well, the chances were much higher because they were loaning to people who traditionally didn't get loans and were much riskier, and the appraisals were off, and there were all sorts of things. Something I'm sort of talking about this too. The difference with litigation is everybody knows that each individual piece of litigation is highly risky. It's not, I mean, and that's why, to your point about banks versus, a bank will make a loan to a law firm or a client if they're creditworthy, but it's guaranteed whether you win or lose the suit, you pay it back, and that's why a law firm may not want to mortgage their house in order to support a case. And so, whereas if it's a non-recourse loan, you know you could lose all the principal. So I don't think there's a risk of runaway speculation with money being pumped in, because the surest way to lose money is to invest in a lawsuit that's going to lose. And then you lose all your capital. It's not like, I mean, even with mortgage-backed securities, as terrible as it was, so if you make a loan on a house and it turns out they default and it's not what you thought it was worth, well, some portion of your loan you won't get paid back. You don't necessarily lose 100% unless you bought the super junior tranche that was the highest risk or lost first. So with a lawsuit, though, if you lose a lawsuit, you lose everything. So it's, you know, it's not capital that people are going to just throw at plaintiffs, and that gets to your vetting function.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
Anyone else? I will just add on to that, though. I mean, there has been a trend toward portfolio investments by third-party litigation funders, precisely to try to replicate this kind of reduction of risk by investing. And so you can go to a law firm and say, you know, I'm not interested in investing in just this one case. I want to see what else you have, and you sort of invest in a little piece of everything. And so, you know, that's a way to mitigate risk to some extent. It's also, though, a way to water down the vetting process, because you're not going to vet every single case, especially if you're buying a particularly large portfolio. Yeah. So it just depends. I mean, it depends on how it's done. Again, it's very hard to generalize because there's, you know, infinite different variations in doing this, and there's many different funders, and they all approach it their own way. But I think that there is a trend toward that, and it'll be interesting to see whether that has the effect of reducing vetting and kind of increasing the amount of litigation generally, and that's sort of the fear on the side of those who are not as angry about third-party litigation funding, is that you'll end up funding a lot of kind of garbage litigation in the process of funding, you know, the more meritorious cases.
I would say that that is just as rigorous. When we work with an Am Law 100 firm, we do a portfolio of cases. Each case has to be vetted. It's in the lawyer's interest as well as the client, as well as the client and the funder, because everybody's taking risks. We don't want to pursue the suit unless it's going to win. And it's more there. It speeds the process, because once you've worked with a law firm once, and you've been through it, and they sort of are used to your spreadsheets laying out what the cost would be, and what, you know, and they're used to how to think about risk. It really helps them. It helps their alternative billing committee at the firm get a grasp on how they should be looking at alternative billing arrangements for their clients.
All right. Well, thank you. I want to thank John and Jeff, and thank you all for coming, and we hope to see you at future Law and Economic Center events.
Thank you.